Welcome once again to Word on the Hills, with me, Felicity Sidnell-Reed, and my co-host, Gwen Sheltimer. Each week at this time, we visit with authors, poets, editors, publishers, or anyone connected with the writing world in our region. However, this week we are celebrating the second anniversary of Word on the Hills, with a collage of pieces from new books and other writing published by Spirit of the Hills Writers in 2015. Gwen and I are members of the Spirit of the Hills Writers Group, and when we first started, we thought we would centre the series around the work of our members, and we have done that. But we've also expanded the scope of the programme to bring you poetry, novels, short fiction, memoir, plays, and non-fiction written by people who live all over our region. There is endless talent here, and plenty of people who are working to produce and publish. In between the readings, we'll bring you a little history of the programme and how it has grown and where we see it go in the future. But first, Gwen, what are we going to feature in today's readings?
Well, Northumberland writers have certainly been busy in 2015. We've got a great lineup of story excerpts, non-fiction, and a few poems too, and all from writers who have published new books in the last year. In the first set, we're going to hear from five writers, and the pieces they will read have been chosen because of their ties to the landscape. First, we'll join memoir writer and teacher Diane Taylor, who reads from her non-fiction book, The Gift of Memoir, about the importance of including landscape in writing. Then blogger Mark Richardson takes us on a bit of a road trip with an excerpt from his book, Zen and Now, on the trail of Robert Persick and the art of motorcycle maintenance. Then, Felicity, you're going to read an historical excerpt from your newly published novel, Alone, A Winter in the Woods, which is set right here in Northumberland in 1797. Then we're off to Peru to hear a piece from Shane Joseph's novel, In the Shadow of the Conquistador. And we'll round out the set with a short piece from Brian Mullally as a tribute to a dear member of our group who sadly passed last July. So, listeners, sit back, relax, and enjoy.
Place is a powerful and permanent part of the people we become. What am I but a person in a place at a particular time? Place can be a room, a house, a boat, a street, a tent, or a vanished neighborhood like the Irish Griffin Town in Montreal. And crucial to that place is the living, breathing, great outdoors with all its majesty and interaction with us. In a very real scientific sense, the earth breathes us, and we breathe the earth. When we include the botany and geology of our particular place on earth in our history, we are moving beyond the boundaries of ego into natural history, from ego towards eco. We know about human rights. Ecuador is the first country in the world to grant rights to plant life. The Ecozoic era is upon us. Bring awareness of it into your memoir. Happy landing, fellow geologians, as you recreate with words your particular place on earth. Let us, your readers, see the trees and trout, hear the moles and mosquitoes, and touch the furrows and fire. Imagine it alive and breathing alongside you.
There's been a track here for centuries, paved sometime in the 1920s or 30s, to better link farmers with their markets, Bible salesmen with their customers, children with their schools. This is the kind of road on which life happens, connecting other roads and streets and driveways and communities, not a throughway that picks you up here and throws you off there. It meanders around properties and makes way for the marshes that breed the ducks and the red-winged blackbirds that take flight as I ride past. Clickety-clack. The only way to truly experience a road like this is to be out in the open, not shut up in a car, but riding along on top of it on a motorcycle. It's tough to explain to someone who's only ever traveled behind a windshield, sealed in with the comforting thunk of a closing door. On a bike, there's no comforting thunk. The road is right there below you, blurring past your feet, ready to scuff your soul should you pull your boot from the peg and let it touch the ground. The wind is all around you and through you while the sun warms your clothing and your face. Take your left hand from the handlebar and place it in the breeze. and it rises and falls with the slipstream as if it were a bird's wing. Breathe in and smell the new-mown grass. Laugh out loud, and your voice gets carried away on the wind. At least, that's how it is on a warm, sunny day like this Monday morning. Some rain a couple of days ago was a struggle, but I won't think about that now. There'll be plenty of time for that later.
John stared down the slope between the trunks of the maples towards the dark path his father had taken. The forest blurred as his eyes filled, but Bonnie was squirming in his arms again and licking his face, so he swallowed his tears and set her down. She too peered down the slope to where the trail joined the path across their land. For a moment, John thought she might take off after his father, but though she hesitated and barked once, she turned back to him and jumped up, pulling at his sleeve. John stood still for several minutes in the wet, trampled snow outside the log cabin he and Pa had spent the past weeks building, gazing after his father. He imagined his progress down the gentle slope alongside the ice-choked creek, back on the trail they had travelled together not so many weeks before. If he shut his eyes, he could see again the rough road from the old settlement, often marked only by blazes on the trees and a narrow pathway. Now the hardest, coldest weeks of the winter, when they could walk over the solid ice in the bays of Lake Ontario, were over. Pa would have to hug the shore and pay attention to the state of the ice all the way back to Adolphustown. When they had set out, the rest of the family had stood in the snow watching them, their eyes filling with tears, as he and Pa had slowly moved out of sight. Now it was his turn to feel the loneliness of parting.
The trail began through flat country. Mountains beckoned in the distance. So did the rain cloud. We had to go up and down two mountains. The first one, Dead Woman's Pass, being the tallest, at nearly 14,000 feet above sea level. During the first couple of hours, we passed villages and fields. Some sprung up around volcanic rocks that had rolled down the mountains during earthquakes. The threat of imminent extinction hung in the air, but the attitude of shrugging off disaster and carrying on with a smile held true in the faces of the locals who waved us past. My stomach had settled after leaving Cusco, but I felt weak and was glad for the flat terrain. I was also reassured that we had opted for our four Quechua men to carry our tents and cookware for us. They nimbly skipped ahead along the ancient stones of the trail, and Valdez advised us that we would next see them at the camp that night, where our tents would be made and dinner simmering. After a brief stop for a sandwich lunch, we began the climb. We were only traveling 4 kilometers that day, but it felt like 40. The steps that made up the trail from this point were broken and uneven, and steep and narrow in places. The rain started to come down midway. At first it was refreshing from the sweat of the trek, but as we ascended, it turned cold. George fell behind, and Valdez kept pace with him, bringing up the rear, and I was on my own for most of the section of the climb. I pulled on a sweater that got quickly soaked, threw on a poncho, and increased my pace. The light started to diminish at the halfway point. Turning around, I discovered that I was alone on the trail. Only the steps heading steeply down indicated where I had come from. I heard faint voices below. Valdez and George were somewhere out of sight. When I stopped, the voices amplified. Satisfied, I continued. My muscles began to cramp. Raising a leg onto the next stone step became difficult, then impossible. I started to panic. Should I turn back? My water bottle was long empty. Besides, the Diamox took it all out anyway in frequent passing of urine. But just like the night before, I wanted to keep going. The sheer rush of adrenaline, the fact that I was doing something I had never attempted before, and the fact that George, who was in worse condition than me, was behind, was motive enough to keep moving, despite the freezing limbs and groans that were by now unshakable companions on the journey.
The old brick house stood on the east side of the toll road, just beyond the village of Cewstoke, and the open land behind the dwellings rose steeply and crested on the county road. Across the road from the house, A crumbling stone wall hid the field that sloped down to the sea. When Danny stood at his bedroom window, he could see over the wall and follow the line of ancient stepping stones that ran across the meadow and led down to the bay. In ancient times, monks in pale grey habits had descended these steps at the end of their working day and walked down the narrow path that led to the chapel. On stormy nights, Atlantic rollers raced up the Bristol Channel and streamed across the bay until they crashed against the seawall. On the way to school, the fog left brine crystals on Danny's face, and he liked to lip his lips and taste the ocean with the tip of his tongue. Danny attended the one-room village school while he waited for approval to transfer to the county grammar school. The village children regarded him with great suspicion. Break time, they huddled in the corner of the tiny playground and made fun of his Cockney accent. Freddie White was the exception. The red-headed son of a fisherman, he liked to hear Danny's war stories and laugh at his jokes. Back home at his London school, Danny would have ignored Freddie. The two-year age difference would have been an insurmountable barrier, but here in Somerset, Danny was glad of Freddie's company. At the end of the short summer day, the sun quickly descended behind the distant hills, and the fog returned to shroud the village in mystery. On his way home, Danny listened to the wind sighing between the stone houses and strained his ears to hear the deep-throated chant of the monks. Freddie scrambled up beside him when his new friend climbed on top of the stone wall, and Danny laughed and pointed a pinpoint of light blinking in the meadow far below. "It looks like a lantern leading the monks back to their monastery." Freddie shook his head. "Nay, 'tis only old Albert Morrissey lighting his way to the barn." Freddie had to spring off the wall and run to catch up with Danny. "Mind you," Freddie gasped as he tried to recover his breathing, "folks do claim them steps as haunted, and none of the villagers will chance using them after it's dark."
You have been listening to our second anniversary collage of excerpts from books published this last year. You heard Diane Taylor reading from The Gift of Memoir, Mark Richardson reading from his book Zen and Now, On the Trail of Robert Persick and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance. Felicity Sitnell Reed reading from Alone, A Winter in the Woods, Shane Joseph reading from In the Shadow of the Conquistador, and Brian Mullally reading from his short story The Ghosts of Walbury Hill, published in Hill Spirits 2. Join us again for more after this short break.